Our next case this morning is In Re Evanston Northwestern Healthcare, case number 102514. Ms. Fate, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Mary Jane Fayette on behalf of plaintiff's appellants. We are here on plaintiff's Rule 23F petition for review of the district court's denial of class certification in this hospital merger antitrust litigation. There are two issues that are on appeal. The first issue is that the district court failed to rule on plaintiff's Daubert motion to exclude defense experts' opinion, an opinion that was unreliable, confusing, and irrelevant to the core issues in the case, the hospital's anti-competitive exercise of market power. The court committed legal error under American Honda. Under American Honda, the court must rule on a Daubert motion prior to deciding a class certification motion. It must make determinations of fact and legal and resolve legal questions that are relevant to the entire class certification requirements. This is a legal issue that is reviewed by the court de novo. We believe in this case Dr. Noether's opinion was critical to the district court's class certification decision. The court's decision was infected with Dr. Noether's misunderstanding and misapplication of the impact standard in this case. The district court cited her repeatedly in its opinion and was confused that the price changes and price variations that Dr. Noether cited had something to do with impact when, in fact, they were merely related to restructuring and price changes unrelated to the exercise of market power. The FTC and both the district court had found that Dr. Noether's opinions were unreliable, weak, and misleading. Nevertheless, the court, by not deciding the Daubert motion, committed what we consider relevant and important error here. Because if the district court had ruled on plaintiff's Daubert motion, it would not have been able to base its decision on Dr. Noether's perspective and views. We also believe that Honda is intended and should apply to both denials and grants of class certification. Under Szabo, the court, when deciding a class certification motion, must decide relevant issues to class certification and whether the expert testimony is, in fact, reliable and relevant. And because the court dodged that question with regard to Dr. Noether, it fell into error in relying on her opinions. The second issue on appeal, Your Honors, is also a legal issue. It's whether the district court erred in its finding of lack of predominance based on some minor variations in price due to restructuring in one contract. And that was, again, as a result of Dr. Noether's analysis and the court's failure to consider the overwhelming evidence of impact in this case as a result of the exercise of market power by the hospital. The court, in its decision, said that plaintiffs must show that market power increases as to each managed care organization were applied to each class member. That's at Appendix 54, page 54 of the opinion. By doing so, the district court clearly applied the wrong legal standard in this court. Under Rule 23B, plaintiffs need not show that there is impact as to every class member, but that there are common issues of fact or law that predominate. And that's clearly stated in very recent opinions of this court in Cohen, in Pella, and in Schleicher. Under Pella, the proper standard is whether plaintiffs showed that a common core of issues predominated. That is clear here. The plaintiffs have shown that there was an antitrust violation. The FTC's evidence as to this is prima facie evidence in this case. And it has also shown that the impact occurred to all of the MCOs that were customers of the hospital.
Blue Cross is the biggest member of the plaintiff class, is that right?
Blue Cross's purchases were the largest, but they were not the majority. They were 33% of the purchases.
The biggest single payer.
It was the biggest single payer, but the court needs to understand also that it's not just Blue Cross Blue Shield who paid those rates. It was also the members of the class who subscribed to those rates through their being self-insured. So in other words, there were hundreds of self-insureds, such as employers and pension funds, who paid the hospital directly using Blue Cross Blue Shield's rates.
So they got the benefits of Blue Cross's bargaining power.
Insofar as there were benefits, although we disagree that there were across-the-board benefits. But, yes, the self-insureds and other class members who paid according to the Blue Cross Blue Shield rate were identically damaged as in the same way that Blue Cross Blue Shield was.
In the same way, if I recall correctly, though, Blue Cross Blue Shield had just entered into a new contract when the merger took effect, right?
Blue Cross Blue Shield's contract had been negotiated pre-merger.
Right.
And it started in 2000. In 2002,
And so, if I recall correctly, let me know, please, if I've got this wrong. In the early years after the merger, Blue Cross Blue Shield did not show price increases comparable to those that other MCOs were paying.
What the evidence
shows. At least for inpatient.
For inpatient, the FTC found, and the experts differed. Dr. Haas Wilson's, the FTC's expert, did find impact on inpatient. I forget the name Dr. Baker. For the defense, found there was little impact for inpatients. So it's not clear, and the discovery is not closed in this case, as whether that is actually the fact. But when Dr. Dranov did his own analysis and used Dr. Baker's methodology, he found very little impact for inpatient up until the contract was renegotiated in 2003 for the period 2004 onward. At any rate, getting back to my point about the common impact, there's a plaintiff's burden is to show central questions of the case are the same for all class members, that there was an antitrust violation in this case, and that it caused harm, and that's clear under Pella. The common issues as to liability in this case under Pella are enough to grant class certification and to show predominance. The FTC trial clearly showed that there was an anti-competitive impact as to all of the managed care organizations, including Blue Cross Blue Shield, at least for outpatient services. Our analysis by Dr. Dranov showed that the impact as to Blue Cross Blue Shield, for example, continued on past the 2004 period through 2008.
Ms. Fayette, let me just raise one concern that I have about the way this case has been structured at this point. I get the impression that at one level we're being asked, or maybe the plaintiffs are being asked, can plaintiffs prove the merits of their case as to all class members, including Blue Cross Blue Shield, for example, as a prerequisite for getting a class certified? And frankly, I'm troubled with that turning Eisen on its head and requiring plaintiffs to prove the merits of their case in order to get a class certified.
I agree with Your Honor. We are not required to prove the merits of our case and issues as to actual damages or to individual injury as to class members can wait till the damages and allocation phase of the case.
You have to come forward with a methodology.
Correct, Your Honor.
To show that you can resolve those issues on a class-wide basis.
Correct, Your Honor. But Cohen and Schleicher and Pella say that if there are individual issues that come up, as long as they don't predominate in the case, that does not preclude class certification. And the evidence shows here that there was widespread and uniform exercise of market power across all services and and all of the MCOs, the managed care organizations.
I see the problem here as one of degree. You know, to what extent and to what level of specificity and uniformity does anti-competitive impact need to be shown in order to get the class certified. And that's what the fight is about, or so it seems to me. The standard applied by the district court was a very high one, and you're suggesting that the case law implies, anyway, that it's not quite so high. So where do we draw the line?
I think that you draw the line in whether there, and I think the judge, it's said in Cohen that unless there's evidence that a great number of class members are not injured at the class certification stage, class certification is not precluded. And in this case, I mean, another way to look at it, and this court hasn't said it exactly like this, but if you've shown widespread impact, that would be sufficient.
Widespread non-uniform impact is okay.
Yes, it actually is. It doesn't have to be uniform impact. It has to be impact. And whether there is some non-uniform impact is something that is decided later at the damages phase.
Okay.
Although we would disagree that there was non-uniform impact because there's no evidence that the hospital exercised its market power selectively as to certain services and not others.
Right, but that's not an issue we need to resolve, the extent of the uniformity from your position. That's just a red herring.
We do not need to resolve that at this point.
Let me ask you, are there any issues that the district court addressed that could be solved by adjusting your proposed class definition?
If, for example, later it was discovered that Blue Cross Blue Shield had no damages for 2000 to 2003, which we don't think is the case, at least as inpatient, for example, that mm-hmm. could be resolved by refining the definition of the class, refining the class definition. We think, however, that the class definition is not overbroad in any way. It is including all of those who could have been impacted by this merger. It is not obvious that any of the class members would not have been injured, and if they were, it would be on a very small basis, because as Dr. Dranov found, 75% or more of the prices in the contracts were had a uniform rate of increase, and that although he didn't require uniformity,
75% of the contracts or 75% of the products or services?
75% of the services increased at a uniform rate in all of the contracts that he looked at, and he had access to all of the contracts. So the prices that Dr. Noether pulled out, and she claimed variability, were a very small minority. And even the contracts where she claimed there was variability, there was a large degree of uniform.
Ms. Fant, let me ask you to address what I understand to be one of the defense's principal arguments here, which in essence is that you all and Dr. Dranov painted yourselves into a corner, that you agreed to the uniformity standard, the 100% uniformity standard that was being argued by the defense and that may have been adopted by the district court. And particularly the exchange at 1324 in your appendix when the court was questioning Dr. Dranov.
Right, and I have that in front of mm-hmm. me. And, in fact, several times in Dr. Dranov's reports and at this very hearing, he said that absolute uniformity was not required to show market impact in this case. He used it as evidence of common impact, that there was widespread impact. It was not necessary that he find 100% uniform rates of price increase. And he says this over and over again. He says it at A2711 through A2712. At the hearing, the defendants misquote what actually was said at the hearing. I don't know if you would like me to read what actually the exchange was, but the court says, "It seems, well, there are two things that I want to ask you about. One is the viability of your method, it seems to me. Comes down to two questions. One is, did ENH really increase prices at a uniform rate across services?" And what the defendant's quote is, Dr. Dranov said, "That's exactly correct." But they don't go on to say that he explains that. And if we believe that what is going on here is there is an exercise in market power, we are now 10% stronger or 10% higher prices, and the differences along the margins are restructuring or bringing about prices in line with costs, then the methodology I have introduced is exactly appropriate for identifying the common increase. So he has always said that there was acknowledged restructuring. He's acknowledged the variations. He's saying that is not those variations and that restructuring do not imply lack of market power and lack of common impact.
Would it be accurate to say, for example, let's focus on the 25% or so of services where the nominal price increases were different. Okay. Suppose you pick a service as to which there's been a technological improvement so that instead of having to treat something with an elaborate surgically implanted device, you can treat it with a drug. Costs plummet. I understood Dranoff's theory to be, in essence, yeah, you should expect to see costs dropping substantially for all hospitals in delivering that service, but the price drop will be smaller if the hospital has market power. Is that accurate?
Well, that's one way of saying it. The DID analysis compares the price changes at North Shore compared to a wide variety of mm-hmm. control group hospitals that all have changes in costs, and so that is supposed to factor out the irrelevant impact of those changes in costs from the analysis. Mm-hmm. I do want to say, however, though, that no one in this case, including the defendants, have quantified what they say is the variability or lack of market impact. In fact, Dr. Noether says specifically she's not saying that these variations related to lack of market power. She's saying they relate to cost. And the defendants have never quantified the number of class members it claims were not impacted at all in this case, and that a 25% number, I think, is probably an inaccurate statement because it's not shown by the evidence. The 75% I was quoting was the actual rates that showed a common increase, but that was an average. Actually, the rates in some of the contracts were a 100% uniform. So it's what he was saying there is even if we take the most conservative estimate, which is 75%, but there's been no evidence that there is a large percentage of class members who suffered no rate increase as a result of the market power. I see my light is on, and I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
That's fine. Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. I think the place to begin this discussion is perhaps on page 2450 of the appendix, which is the plaintiff's reply brief in support of their motion for class certification. They acknowledge on that page that they must demonstrate that they have a workable common method of analyzing impact and damages. And they even cite the hydrogen peroxide case from the Third Circuit, which, as you know, holds that there can be no predominance in a class action case unless the plaintiffs have a workable method of establishing impact on a class-wide basis. So they voluntarily assumed that burden. And so the heart of this case really is Judge Lefkoe's factual finding in response to plaintiffs' own approach, and this is on page 57 of her opinion, where she found that plaintiffs' own proposed method of proving class-wide impact relies on an assumption that they have not been able to validate. That is, the assumption that E&H increased prices at a uniform rate across services. And indeed, she concluded that plaintiffs have not put forth credible evidence to validate that assumption. Now, although the plaintiffs haven't challenged that central finding or either of its two parts as clearly erroneous, They instead contend that it was legal error, but it can't be legal error since it was the burden that they themselves voluntarily shouldered.
Did they assume a burden to show there must be 100% uniformity in the variation of nominal prices?
That's how they said that
where?
They would.
Where did they say it that specifically?
I'm sorry. What they said. And there was never any dispute about this. What they said is that they have to show all or substantially all prices increased at a uniform rate. That was also what E&H's witness said, all or substantially all. And that, from all appearances, is the standard that the judge applied. And so what I would like to do is I'd like to briefly review first why Judge Lefkoe's finding is not only plausible but correct, and then I'd like to explain why neither their procedural argument under American Honda nor their more substantive attacks on her analysis can possibly justify a holding that she abused her discretion in denying certification. Now, in the district court, and I mentioned this already, in an effort to show that they could prove impact on a class-wide basis pursuant to hydrogen peroxide, they attempted to show that after the merger, E&H's prices rose at a uniform rate for substantially all services. And their expert, Dr. Drainoff, acknowledged that a demonstration of average injury is not alone sufficient for common impact. And so, as he put it in his reply report, uniformity of price changes was, as he put it, a crucial fact. That's at page 2523 of the appendix.
Uniformity in absolute terms?
That's what he said. He said uniformity.
We have to evaluate that in the context of his entire expert report. And I don't think the conclusion of absolute uniformity, as in 100%, is fair.
No, again, and I'm not saying that he was claiming absolute uniformity. Nobody claimed that. That is really a straw man before this court. E&H didn't say there had to be 100% uniformity. The judge didn't say that there had to be 100% uniformity. But the problem was that they were not even able to establish uniformity as to a substantial percentage of the prices. They were not able to establish what Dr. Drainoff said they needed to establish, which was that substantially all of the prices increased at a uniform rate. And as we discussed earlier, he admitted under questioning from the district court that the viability of his whole approach to antitrust impact depended on whether, and I quote, E&H really increased prices at a uniform rate across services. And in fact, he said that he talked about some other reasons that he thought the prices had been uniform. He talked about court decisions on market definition. He talked about E&H documents, but he said that this uniform price increase point was one of the three legs of his three-legged stool, and therefore, if you knock that leg out, the stool would fall. Now, Dr. Drainoff also opined that price increases under E&H contracts with insurers are uniform not only across services, but across each respective payer contract. And that's at page 2460. And his conclusions for each payer were summarized in a series of charts, which appear at Appendix D of his report. And one of those, for what was called Payer A, appears at page 2615 of the Joint Appendix, and that's right near the end of Volume 5, and it's worth examining just for a moment. Now, if you look at that chart, it's entitled Uniformity of Price Increases for Payer A Contracts for Inpatient Service, and lines 2 and 3 show that Dr. Drainoff's analysis of price changes from 2001 to 2003. It summarizes his analysis of those price changes. And his conclusion in the right-hand column, and this is where the 100% straw man comes from, his own conclusion based on his supposed examination of those contracts and the price changes they called for was that the prices uniformly increased 100% of the time. And so that was his own conclusion, and he said that those prices increased uniformly 100% of the time for both of those years. Now, this very chart became the subject of a dispute during an extensive 4-hour certification hearing before Judge Lefkoe. E&H's witness presented some simple calculations based on the two contracts that are cited at the bottom of this very chart. And on the basis of those simple calculations, she showed that fewer than half the prices had, in fact, increased at a uniform rate. The court then examined both E&H's witness and examined Dr. Drainoff, and then she asked counsel, how can I resolve this dispute between these two experts? And plaintiff's counsel, Ms. Fayette, said, Your Honor, I think you're just going to have to look at the numbers yourself. And so that's exactly what Judge Lefkoe did. And when she did that, she first saw that the two contracts, which are reproduced at the very end of the appendix, and they're very short. They comprise a total of about six pages. She first saw that those two contracts have escalator clauses specifying uniform price increases of about 2.5% to 4% per year for many services. But then she saw, when she examined the second contract that was renegotiated in 2002, that the baseline prices for more than half the specific services did not, in fact, change at a uniform rate. And so for the period from January 2002 to January 03, she found that rather than showing 100% uniformity, Drainoff's chart that we looked at just a minute ago should have said that fewer than 50% of the prices were changing at a uniform rate. Now, as Judge Lefkoe also found, that
Mr.
discrepancy...
Mr. Chair,
I'm
troubled by the focus on, let me just use the term nominal prices, okay?
Okay.
And the reason I want to use that phrase is because we can expect that that across an array of medical services, there will be all kinds of changes in cost inputs and different ways of calculating. For example, do you include the doctor's services and the price for the catheterization and so on?
Right.
All those kinds of factors can be changing constantly. It's a complex area. I had understood Dr. Drainoff's methodology, though, by looking not just at any one particular payer's contract to reach this conclusion, but by comparing prices in the control group of hospitals with price changes at the defense hospitals, which at least as I understand it, is intended to, in essence, average out those individual variations in the cost inputs of different services.
Right, and that's true. That is the method that he initially said he was going to rely on. But once Dr. Noether pointed out the problems with that methodology, he then disclaimed that. In fact, he said that that our attempt to show common impact is a function not of that statistical analysis, the DID analysis, but the contracts themselves and his analysis of the contracts, which was presented in Appendix D. So he backed away from that position and came to the approach that's represented there on page 2615 of the Joint Appendix. So Judge Lefkoe found that the problems that she saw with this chart, D4, revealed a fundamental problem with his whole analysis, which, as she found, she said, Drainoff's analysis focused primarily on price changes within contracts, changes that are usually attributable to escalator clauses, rather than price changes across contracts, where the plaintiffs themselves admitted any market power would be exercised if there was any market power. Now, although Drainoff said that he had taken those changes across contracts into account, Judge Lefkoe's own analysis, her own review of the contract, showed that those changes were not fully reflected at a minimum in his numbers, and therefore that his numbers on that chart for Payer A were flatly incorrect as a result. She took into account the restructuring that he had talked about, but she concluded that restructuring point only applied to a very small subset of the changes that she observed from her review of the contract. She found that could apply to three of the 18 specific prices that were reported here on chart D4. And so, on that basis, she concluded that the plaintiffs themselves had not presented credible evidence that E&H increased prices across contracts at uniform rates. Now, like her finding that the plaintiff's method relied on an assumption of uniform price changes, this finding also was at a minimum plausible, given the evidence and the record as a whole, and therefore it can't be clearly erroneous. And in fact, the plaintiffs have never even denied that that this chart, Appendix D4, was dead wrong in claiming 100% uniformity. So instead of squarely arguing that the factual findings on which Judge Lefkoe based her decision are wrong, they've resorted to a procedural challenge that, through some miracle, was dumped in their lap just a few days after Judge Lefkoe issued her decision on class certification, which was the American Honda decision. Of course, they didn't bring that to Judge Lefkoe's decision and ask for reconsideration or rehearing on that basis. They immediately filed a 23F petition, relying principally on that decision.
But the American Honda decision was not the result of a miracle, but perhaps the force of law.
It was a miracle of timing. is all I would say. And we have no quarrel with American Honda.
To the benefit of it now.
That's right. And we have no quarrel at all
so
with
why should we ignore it?
With American Honda. But their argument is, of course, that under American Honda, Judge Lefkoe abused her discretion. They call it a legal error, but in fact, it's American Honda itself makes clear that it's a standard of discretion, and they claim that she abused her discretion in denying certification without first conducting a full Daubert analysis of Dr. Noether. But that argument fails for at least three reasons. First of all, even assuming that American Honda applies to denials of certification, the plaintiffs haven't established a violation of that decision. For one thing, Judge Lefkoe did not take a provisional approach to certification, which was really the heart of the American Honda decision. For another, to the extent that Judge Lefkoe cited or considered any analysis from Dr. Noether, it was not the kind of analysis that's typically subject to a Daubert analysis. There were no novel scientific methods or even statistical methods or anything like that. It was a simple examination of contracts and comparing numbers across contracts. And most importantly, American Honda itself did not create a broad sweeping rule that any time there's an issue with respect to the admissibility of expert testimony at the class certification stage, that a district court is required, no matter what, to conduct a Daubert hearing. American Honda, first of all, gave district judges a lot of discretion in how they conduct those hearings, but also limited its holding to expert opinions that are critical, and the opinion uses that word, expert opinions that are critical to the outcome. And plaintiffs have not even begun to carry their burden of showing that Judge Lefkoe's consideration of Noether's analysis was critical to the outcome of the decision. They don't even acknowledge that aspect of American Honda.
Would you agree then that American Honda needs to apply to, though, critical expert evidence for both grants and denials of certification?
Well, our briefs explain why we think it makes sense to limit it to grants of certification. But this,
so it's okay for defendants to rely on inadmissible evidence? Is that the theory?
Well, again, we explain in our briefs why we think
you've got
that
other
makes
arguments.
Sense.
It's okay to back away from that one if you want to.
And I won't, Your Honor, with all respect, but this case doesn't hang on that point. And you can
note it.
Second, even if there were a technical violation of American Honda, the plaintiffs haven't shown prejudice, which of course they have to do to get a reversal.
Actually, much of Judge Lefkoe's decision was based on Dr. Noether's theory.
Well, again, with all respect, it wasn't a theory. It was a series of calculations, Your Honor. And
she does cite
Dr. Noether. There's no question.
Repeatedly, and she adopts her criticisms of Dr. Dranoff's report in many significant respects. And so,
true,
to me, the decision was substantially colored by Dr. Noether's opinions.
But only after she conducted her own independent analysis at the plaintiff's suggestion, to verify herself with her own calculations that Dr. Noether was correct. And in fact, she even disagreed on a couple of issues with Dr. Noether and still reached her own her own opinion. But again, even if there were a technical violation of American Honda, the plaintiffs haven't shown that American Honda would have entitled them to any more process than they received. Judge Lefkoe held a lengthy hearing. They haven't alleged, much less demonstrated, that a full-blown Daubert analysis would likely have resulted in the exclusion of Dr. Noether's analyses. In fact, the contract analysis that Judge Lefkoe considered was squarely within the expertise that plaintiffs themselves acknowledged she had. At page 2640, they acknowledged that she had expertise in the relationships between hospitals and healthcare plans, and that's all. That's the only part of Dr. Noether's analysis that.
But we don't parse admissibility decisions like that, though. I mean, either her testimony was admissible in its entirety or it was inadmissible, and the judge needed to make that ruling before relying on it. And it seems to me it's pretty clear she didn't, because she ducked it.
Well, and then
she relied on much of what Dr. Noether had said. You know, granted, she looked at some things on her own, but it seems to me that she substantially relied on Dr. Noether's opinion in her criticism of Dr. Dranos.
Well, in all fairness, Your Honor, she didn't duck the point. And this gets me to my final point on American Honda. The point was never squarely made to her, okay? There were two separate
Every time the plaintiffs raised an objection, the district court told them, be quiet, wait, we'll deal with this later.
They never said, Your Honor, we think this should be excluded. We think this analysis, that is, there were two analyses presented by Dr. Noether. There was an initial report, and then the report that was discussed at the hearing, and the only one that Judge Lefkoe even, from what the evidence shows, considered, was the second report that she submitted responding to Dr. Dranoff's attempts to implement this new method of showing perfect uniformity or near-perfect uniformity. And at the hearing, they never made a motion to exclude that report. They never said, Your Honor, we don't think this is proper under Daubert. Of course, they couldn't cite American Honda because it hadn't come down yet.
Right, but they had a standing objection to the expert's testimony based on the motion that had been filed, and so they don't have to continually raise it each time the expert announces a new or revised opinion or is asked to opine on a different subject area during the course of the hearing. The objection is a standing one, and that's good enough.
The judge
did duck it here. She specifically said, I don't have to rule on Daubert, and I'm giving the expert's opinion the weight that it's worth or the weight that it's due, something to that. I don't know what we're supposed to make of that. What does that mean?
Well, she concluded, after she had done her own independent analysis of the core issues, and this gets back to the requirement of American Honda, that the opinion at issue be critical to the decision, she pretermitted that issue by going back and doing the analysis herself.
Having given the expert's opinion the weight that it's due.
Well,
we don't know what that is, other than reading between the lines of what she said, which substantially relied on the expert's opinion.
Well, she ultimately went back and did the analysis herself and concluded that chart at D4 was just dead wrong. That hasn't been disputed here. And it was on that basis that she concluded that there was no credible evidence to support the conclusion. If this court, and I see my time is up, but let me just make this last point. If this court were to find that there were an error and that it wasn't waived, the appropriate remand would be to send the case back and allow Judge Lefkoe to determine in the first instance whether this analysis from Dr. Noether really was critical within the meaning of American Honda, allow her to determine, at least in the first instance, whether there was a waiver of the Daubert objection based on the record that was before her, before subjecting her and the parties to the expense of a massive Daubert hearing. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Fayette. You've got 3 minutes.
First of all, I just want to bring to the Court's attention, if you don't already know, that this case has been reassigned to Judge Chang, the District Court Judge Chang, and is no longer before Judge Lefkoe. I just want to point out that in Cohen can be read to say it's defendant's burden to come forward and show that many class members were not injured if you've already shown a widespread impact. And
could you address the D4
yes.
chart?
I'm sorry, the
chart that that opposing counsel was telling us about.
Appendix D?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Appendix D is an analysis by Dr. Dranov of the uniform rates of price increase across all of the contracts. He specifically states in his introduction to Appendix D and also in the body of his reply report that does not include, and he's not attempting to show that this as to restructured contracts. And so that's his point was to show, well, let me go back a little bit. The DID analysis here was to show widespread impact and damages by comparing prices at a North Shore University Hospital versus a control group. Then Dr. Dranov went even further. He said, I'm going to show that this impact was widespread across all services, not just as a lump for inpatient and outpatient contracts. That was the purpose of Appendix D. And that he showed that that there was a uniform rate of price increases for the majority, if not all of the services, for many of the contracts, with the exception of restructuring. Now, one of the things that defense keeps harping back to is a statement I made at the hearing asking Judge Lefkoe to look at the numbers herself. Unfortunately, she only looked at one set of numbers, and that was the pay array contract, where there was widespread uniformity of 6.1%, with the exception of certain cardiac services, which were shown to have been restructured, and it was clear from the contract that they were restructured. They had excluded in the second contract professional services in the rates for cardiac services. The discussion as to the pay array contract is in Dr. Dranov's rebuttal report. That's at A2720. I also want to give the court the page sites for Dr. Noether's admission that she never was saying that these variations she talked about had anything to do with market power. That's at A2538 and A1368. And we also deal with the actual variability issue in Dr. Dranov's rebuttal report. At A2709, he says repeatedly that these variations had nothing to do with market power, and insofar as Dr. Noether was talking about the variations, she categorized certain things as non-uniform incorrectly, basing them, for example, on calling contracts that used discount off charges as somehow non-uniform.
Could I just ask one follow-up question there? You're referring to the Dranov rebuttal report. I want to make sure, are you referring to the report that was filed before the hearing or the one that was rejected after the hearing?
Well, the Dranov rebuttal report is the one that was filed and rejected. We asked permission to file it and it was rejected.
Okay, that's the one you're referring to.
Correct.
All right. Thank you.
All right. The court has no further questions. We'll rest on our briefs.
All right. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.